Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Madeleine Albright is chair of Albright Stonebridge Group, a global strategy firm, and chair of Albright Capital Management, an investment advisory firm focused on emerging markets. In 1997, Dr. Albright was named 64th Secretary of State of the United States. She was the first female Secretary of State and became, at that time, the highest-ranking woman in the history of the U.S. government. As Secretary of State, Dr. Albright reinforced America's alliances, advocated for democracy and human rights, and promoted American trade, business, labor, and environmental standards abroad. Dr. Albright is professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She chairs both the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs and the Pew Global Attitudes Project and serves as the president of the Truman Scholarship Foundation. She serves on the U.S. Department of Defense's Defense Policy Board. And closer to her former home here in Denver, Dr. Albright also serves on the boards of the Council on Foreign Relations at the Aspen Institute and the Center for American Progress. On May 29th of this year, Dr. Madeleine Albright received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, from President Obama. Dr. Albright is also the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers. We have been honored to host her here at the Tattered Cover for each of these books, and we're delighted that she returns tonight to present her latest, Prague Winter, A Personal Story of Remembrance and War, 1937 to 1948. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Madeleine Albright?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Charles. Thank you. I am delighted to be here, and thank you very much for telling everybody who I am, because not everybody always knows. Not long ago, I was coming back from China, and Chicago was the first port of entry, and I was there getting undressed for the security people, and I put my stuff down on the conveyor belt ahead of me, and the lady ahead of me said, "So where'd you get all those screw top bottles? My bottles all leak." And I got them at the container store. And then I was going through the magnetometer, and the TSA guard looked at me and he said, "Oh my God, it's you." He said, "I'm from Bosnia, and we all love you in Bosnia. And if it weren't for you, there wouldn't be a Bosnia, and you're always welcome in Bosnia." And then he said, "Can I have my picture taken with you?" And I said, "Absolutely." So he stops the whole line. And I go back and pick up my stuff, and the lady of the screw top bottle says, "So what exactly happened here?" And I said, "Well, I used to be Secretary of State." And she said, "Of Bosnia?" So thank you very much. I am really happy to be back in my hometown. I grew up here. My family moved here in 1949, and I lived here until I went to college, and my parents lived here most of their lives. And my mother, on a regular basis, used to say, "There are only 2 great cities in the world, Prague and Denver." So it is very nice to be able to be here to talk about Prague in Denver. Let me tell you a little bit about the book, and then I hope very much to be able to answer your questions. I start the book by saying that I was 59 years old, and I thought I knew my identity, and also that I knew a lot about the country where I was born. It turns out that neither of those assumptions were completely true. I was raised a Roman Catholic, became an Episcopalian when I got married, and found out I was Jewish. And what happened was that when I first, when I was at the UN, my name became kind of in newspapers and some profiles on TV, and all of a sudden I started getting letters from people, some saying, I'm your relative, send money, or I need a visa. Or people would say, well, I knew your father in high school in 1915, which would have been impossible since he was born in 1909. And also, you know, we knew the names in the of the villages that my parents were born in were wrong, or the dates were wrong, or whatever. But in 1996, in November, I got a letter from somebody who said we had all the dates and names and everything right, and said we knew your family to be, both of them, very fine Jewish families. And I look at this and I think, well, that is an interesting new fact about my life. And it was just the time that I was being vetted to be Secretary of State. And I was in the White House counsel's office, and they said, they were kind of asking the normal questions, like, had I paid my taxes, and did I have a nanny, and things like that. And so, and then they said, there's a question we ask everybody at the end. Is there anything about yourself that we didn't ask you that you think we should know? And I said, well, I've just gotten this letter, and it's perfectly possible that I'm of Jewish background. And they said, so what? The president is not anti-Semitic. So when we were actually in Aspen over the Christmas holidays, I discussed this with my children and my son-in-laws, and my children just adored my parents. And they said, well, this just makes an already really complicated story more fascinating. And we just kind of thought, my youngest daughter's married to a Jewish man, and we thought it was all just an additional fact. And then one of the things that happens is you can't, in fact, talk to the press between the time that you are named and the time you're confirmed. And so there was a reporter from the Washington Post who wanted to write a profile of me. So my office gave him names of some people who might know us in Europe. And on the day that I was confirmed, he came into my office and started handing me these really disgusting documents, which the Nazis kept, were very organized, and they kept these horrible cards that in fact said to what concentration camp somebody had been transported and when they died and various things. And he starts handing me these documents with names of my family. And I was just stunned. And it's one thing to find out that you're Jewish. It's another to find out how large numbers of your family died in concentration camps. I had just been named Secretary of State, and while it may seem peculiar at this moment, people did not think a woman could be Secretary of State. And so I had to prove I could be Secretary of State. And the only way I could describe that moment was that I had been asked to represent my country in a marathon. And just as I started, that somebody gave me a heavy package and said, unwrap this as you run. So what I decided to do was to ask my brother and sister to go to the Czech Republic and begin to see if they could figure out the story. And they were met there by a wonderful man called Thomas Kraus, who was head of the Jewish community, and he took them around, and they began to get the story together. And so we began to understand it, but I thought I needed to do much more, and that's the genesis of this book. And it's really written in three kind of layers. The first layer is the inner one of my family story, and I go back and I trace a lot of it. I think I understood my parents a lot better. They were of the first generation of young people that called themselves Czechoslovaks. Czechoslovakia had been started in 1918 as a result of World War I, and based a lot on Woodrow Wilson's 14 points and various principles. The relationship between the United States and Czechoslovakia was very close. In fact, what had happened, the first president of Czechoslovakia was a man called Thomas Garrigue Masaryk. He had married an American woman in the last quarter of the 19th century. Her name was Charlotte Garrigue. And what he did, a little bit unusual even now, is he took her maiden name as his middle name. The Czechoslovak Constitution is modeled on the American Constitution, except for quite an interesting exception. The Czechoslovak Constitution has equal rights language in it, written in 1918. And so there was a great love of every little town in Czechoslovakia has a Vudrov Vilsen railroad station. And so there was this great relationship between the two countries. And these young people, my parents, basically saw themselves as the first generation of Czechoslovaks, not particularly religious. Jews in Czechoslovakia, in many ways, had been, or at least in the Czech part, quite assimilated. And so they saw themselves as this vanguard of a new Czechoslovak nation. My father was a young diplomat, and so the first layer of the story is basically his story. And they spent the war in England with the government in exile, and I was there as a child all through World War II, living in air raid shelters. And so that story about then they came back to Czechoslovakia after World War II, and then my father was made ambassador to Yugoslavia. And then when the communists took over, just before they had taken over, he had been set up to do a new assignment, which was to represent Czechoslovakia at the UN to deal with the problem of India and Pakistan over Kashmir. He's dead, I'm old, that problem is worse than ever. So he came to the United States and did not want to work for the communists. And so he defected and asked for political asylum. And what happened was that the Rockefeller Foundation funded, I can now understand how this works, Central European intellectuals, and they found him a job at the University of Denver. We had no idea where Denver was. And my parents bought a car. We started driving across America. And my mother would say, they call Denver the Mile High City, but we're not going up, so maybe we're going the wrong direction. So he ended up here. He taught and ultimately became dean of the Graduate School of International Studies, which I'm now pleased to say bears his name. So we are very closely associated with it. So that's the first layer. The second layer of the book puts it within its historical context. I think the years 1937 to 1948 are incredibly interesting in terms of history, the decisions made by major powers over the heads of small powers. Munich is the agreement that symbolizes that. And the thing that I hadn't focused on is the extent to which the British and French were exhausted from World War I. And the last thing they wanted to do was to fight another war against Hitler. And so they make a deal. The Czechoslovaks are never at the table. And the British and French make a deal with the Germans and Italians over Czechoslovakia's head. And then Neville Chamberlain goes back to Parliament and says, why should we care about people in faraway places with unpronounceable names? So those decisions and kind of looking at how they were made, why they were made, what were the decisions that took place during World War II, many of which we live with today, I found very interesting as somebody who has been interested in history and political science my whole life. And then the third layer is about the difficulty of making moral decisions. I think that we all think that there are some decisions which are black and white, that one in a difficult position might make the right decision. And I would hope that we would. But in looking at the decisions that were made, I have to tell you, I think they were very hard. And one of the issues that I describe in some detail, and some of you may know about it, when the Germans invaded Czechoslovakia in March 15, 1939, and they divided the country up. Slovakia became an independent country run by a man that was a Nazi sympathizer. And the Czech part was run out of Berlin by a Reichsprotector, Mr. Heydrich, who was the number three person in the Nazi panoply of people. He, in fact, invented the concept of the Holocaust. And the government in exile was trying to figure out what to do, and there were many Czechoslovak members of the military that were training with the British RAF and various other military aspects. And so President Benesch, who had been the successor to President Masaryk and was the legitimate president of Czechoslovakia, leading the government in exile in London, decided that they would use parachutists trained in England to go into, be dropped into the Czech part and assassinate Heydrich, which they did. And as a result of that, the Nazis decided to level an entire town, a town called Lidice. What I didn't know until I started doing research on this book was that my maternal grandmother was rounded up at that time and sent to a concentration camp. And the question really is was it the right decision by President Benesch to assassinate Heydrich and have a whole town die? And there, one can speculate on whether it's right or wrong, but I think that one of the things that happened as a result of that was that the British, who had had trouble recognizing the government in exile, all of a sudden saw their value. And this is the kind of issue that people debate. The other part is whether, and put yourself in the position, if what it must have been like to live in that era and decide that you wanted to save your family or have your children be able to go to school, and the cost was that you had to rat on your neighbor. And you knew that if you didn't say something about your neighbor, that the guy next to you would. So what would you do? So I have really looked at those decisions in a way that I best could, and then also tried to bring them into issues that I had when I was Secretary of State. So one of the things that we did during the Clinton administration was to try to end genocidal killing, ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. And we decided that Milosevic was killing first Bosnians and then Kosovars, not for anything that they had done, but for who they were. And so we had a war over it. And then afterwards, we tried to get Serbs out of various parts of the Balkans. And so people would come to me and say, so what exactly are you doing here? Do you know what your people, the Czechs, did after the war? And what they did was move German Czechs and Germans out of an area called the Sudetenland, so-called because it was south of Germany but the northern part of Czechoslovakia, and to get, they felt that they had in fact opened the doors to Hitler. And so they made them all move out of the Sudetenland and push them into Germany, and people would come to me and say, that you say that what Milosevic did was ethnic cleansing, don't you think that what the Czechs did was ethnic cleansing? And so I think there are many issues that are out there and lessons that can be learned from this period of 1937 to 1948. So this is probably the most personal book I wrote, despite the fact that my first book was were my memoirs, and able to put my own family's personal story into this setting. So with that, I'd be delighted to answer whatever questions you have about anything at all. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just going over, I wonder if you have any recollections of your thoughts when you first came to Denver. I mean, you survived the Battle of Britain. You were a refugee from Yugoslavia, and you come to Denver and go to Kent School. And quite honestly, if you'd gone to South, you and I would have been classmates.
Well, you might be classmates with my sister.
Oh. So I'm wondering, how did you think of this environment, having gone through all this? Do you have any remembrance of your thoughts?
Well, thanks for asking that. First of all, what was so remarkable about my parents was that they managed to make the abnormal seem normal. I mean, I'd had a pretty crazy life by the time I was 12 years old, 11 years old. When my father was ambassador, you know, the picture of the little girl in the national costume that gave flowers at the airport, that's what I used to do for a living. And I spoke, by the time we came to the United States, I spoke Czech and French, and I understood Serbian, and I spoke English with a very English accent. And all of a sudden, we're in this place that I think seemed very calm and quiet, and mostly, I have to say, and my sister and I talk about this a lot, is were things as kind of stark as we remember, and we were refugees. known as displaced persons at the time. And the people, we lived in faculty housing and really had nothing. And what was interesting was how generous and kind people were in terms of lending us furniture and providing. I remember getting ice skates for the first Christmas that we were here, and just people unbelievably kind. I started out school actually here at Moore Junior High, and I went there for 2 years. And then my father heard that Kent was giving scholarships to people, girls. There were 16 girls in our graduating class. And I did not want to go to Kent. I thought I loved Maury, and besides, if you're going to be a ninth grader in junior high, that's a big deal. But our sense about it was that it was so peaceful, and people were so nice. My problem was that I was the first American child, and our parents were unbelievably strict, and very ethnic, if I might put it this way. My mother. First of all, they had people over and served them Czech dumplings, and also my mother read palms, and she was. There may be people here who actually remember them, but she was outrageous. I mean, she'd sit next to some man and say, "I see you are going to have an affair with a beautiful woman," while his wife was sitting. She then stopped reading palms when she looked at my palm and saw that I didn't have a brain line. And she said I was going to have 3 sons and I have 3 daughters, so that part didn't work. Then my father wanted really very much to fit in. So we all know that in Colorado that means to go fishing. But he went fishing in a coat and tie. So all of it didn't quite work, and I think that. But our main feeling was an unbelievable sense of gratitude to the American people and to the people at the University of Denver and the people that were really very kind to us. And to this day, I come to Denver often, and you would think I'd get over this, but Denver looks a little bit different than it did in 1950, What was interesting about Denver was that despite the fact that here it is in the Rocky Mountain Empire, it was very international always. And so my parents fit in very well with that. But I have nothing but pleasant memories about Denver. I love coming here. And when people ask me where I'm from, once I get through the Czech part, I always say Colorado. And then today, we were just driving back from Aspen, and I said to my sister that, first of all, our father specifically said there he had had this great career, and people thought that if things had been normal, he would have ended up as foreign minister of Czechoslovakia, and he did not live in the if department. But he said, there is nothing better than to be a professor in a free country. And today, as we were driving back and looking at the mountains and the vastness of the space, I think the reason they loved it so much was that the openness of the scenery also was a reflection of the openness of the country. And my parents are buried in Golden, so we are very much a Colorado family. Thanks for asking that. All the way in the back. Can you speak up, please? And I said the things I said on purpose. When I described the lessons out of the book, I said that the British and French were tired after World War I. A lot of people, a lot of their military had died, a lot of their young people had died. The United States is tired after the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think that is something that has to be taken into consideration. But I also said you can't let people in faraway places with unpronounceable names die. And so I have thought about this a great deal, and having also for a short amount of time had something to do with American foreign policy, I know how hard it is to decide that you are going to use your troops or intervene in another country. And so one of the things, a lot of people, sometimes I get a question, which is, how did your background affect how you made your decisions? And the truth is that when we were making decisions about Bosnia, for instance, I didn't know anything about my background. I certainly knew about the Holocaust. I just didn't think that there was anything that had particular specific relationship to my family. But I thought it was wrong to let people die simply for who they were, and as I said, not anything that they had done. And so one of the things that has evolved in this day and age is that I think there are people who would say that we didn't know what was going on during World War II. I think probably we did. But now we know everything about what's going on everywhere, thanks to information. So a doctrine has evolved, and it's called responsibility to protect. It is the job of a leader to protect his people, and certainly not to kill them. And so the question is, what is the responsibility of the international community if the leader of a country is murdering his people? So the question is, now what? And I do think that what is going on is that systematically, with the United States as a partner, we are pushing. I teach a course at Georgetown, and I say, foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. That's all it is. So what are the tools? And so what is happening is that the U.S. and the international community is going through its set of tools in terms of very stiff diplomatic diplomacy, multilateral, economic sanctions, and doing more and more in terms of providing humanitarian assistance to the rebels, the insurgents, or whatever one wants to call them, and putting pressure on and having every contingency on the table. And I think we are moving very much to do more in terms of providing assistance to the refugees, trying to figure out how to get non-lethal assistance in. Secretary Clinton was in Turkey a couple of days ago. They are a major player in this. But I think the question that I would ask back to everybody is, given how Americans feel at the moment about, I happen to have supported the war in Afghanistan, I happen to think the war in Iraq is the biggest mistake the United States has made. And so I think people are tired. And we are a democracy, and we have to figure out to what extent we want to get militarily involved in Syria. But I do think that the government is moving to more intervention, not military specifically. But it is an unfolding story every day. The question is, who are all the rebels, and how do we help them? And how does it, in fact, fit into what is an increasingly complex situation in the Middle East, and how it could explode literally into Lebanon and Jordan? But those are the issues that are out there. But I think it's very hard to forget people in faraway places with unpronounceable names. Yes.
On a lighter note,
this pin. Okay. well, let me tell you, I have to begin basically by telling you why you care at all about pins and me. And some of you may have been here from my pin book, but so I repeat myself. But none of the pins wouldn't matter at all if it hadn't been for Saddam Hussein. Because I was sent to the UN right after the Gulf War, and I was an instructed ambassador, and the ceasefire of the Gulf War had been translated into a series of Security Council resolutions, and my job was to make sure that the sanctions stayed on. And so my instructions were to say perfectly terrible things about Saddam Hussein constantly, which he deserved. He'd invaded Kuwait. So all of a sudden a poem appeared in the papers in Baghdad comparing me to many things, but among them an unparalleled serpent. And I happened to have a snake pin, so I wore it when we were doing Iraq. And so when the camera zeroed in on it and they said, why are you doing this? And I said, because I was compared to an unparalleled serpent. And I thought, well, this is fun. So I went out and I bought a lot of pins that reflected what we were going to do. So that's how the whole pin thing happened. So this pin I actually got a year ago when I was in Prague, given to me by a Czech designer. And it's really the two worlds that I have lived in, the European and the American one. So that is the symbol of that. And I thought in talking about Prague and Denver, that made a lot of sense. Thanks for asking that. Yes, and back.
On a happier note, this is a book out about what happened in Czechoslovakia.
Yes?
And racism, a really fascinating issue. If you could comment on what he says, it would really help you a lot. I teach a course on genocide. I shall be using this material in terms of what is less known than cleansing our community. And he says, she strongly condemns the brutalities and other excesses, but she voices no unequivocal outrage over the very phenomenon of deportation. Note, the main victims were not the active Nazis, most of whom were no longer present in 1945, but women, old people, the sick, and the dying, and the children. And this is a charge, really, that you are not being even-handed in terms of what happened, both in Serbia, and I have a feeling that Mr. Douglas would know of this, not about your position on this degree. If you could just reflect for a few moments on some of the differences between something you raised, and that is the problem of Serbia, right, and the problem of what happened with the expulsion of Germans from Serbia.
Right. And that, thank you for asking that, and that is kind of what I started saying in terms of the criticism and the question. What I did not know, and this is when my opening sentence here was that I didn't know about my own identity or Czechoslovakia. And I had grown up with a myth of Czechoslovakia being kind of this perfect country, a democracy in the middle of a very mixed group of neighbors. And I found quite shocking when I went back there in 1989-90 with President Havel, that all of a sudden there were a lot of documentation that came out about the way that the Czechs treated the Germans after the war. And I did find it quite stunning in terms of the not just the expulsion, but that there were a number of people were drowned or burned or various things. I think revenge is a very, sad to say, natural kind of feeling among people, and it was all revenge. I found it shocking, and President Havel actually apologized, and he was criticized a lot by the people for saying that. On this review, I'm a little surprised that he raised this point, because I specifically did talk about it. But I have to say something which may sound peculiar to you, but I got my PhD at Columbia, and I wrote my dissertation on the role of the Czechoslovak press in 1968. And I went back and I did a lot of research about Czechoslovakia during the Bohemian period under the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the kind of tradition of a free press in Bohemia and then Czechoslovakia, which was, frankly, the only democracy in the region. So as a professor, this might not surprise you. My PhD, my dissertation board, was composed of every Central European that taught at Columbia. And each of them would say, well, why are you saying your country was so wonderful when actually my country was so wonderful? And one of these people was István De, who is a Hungarian. So they had a bit of a problem because after, thanks to the 14 points, some Hungarians were included in the new Czechoslovakia, as were some Poles. And one of the things that happened after Munich and the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia in north in Sudetenland, both the Poles and the Hungarians immediately came in and took their piece of it. So the relationship was not exactly terrific. I do think I can be charged with many things, but not having a sensitivity to this. It has worried me a lot, frankly, the behavior of the Czechs after World War II. And when you read that part of the book, I think that I was more than fair. I have to say the following thing. One of my truly, this may sound strange, but you actually make really good friends with your counterparts. And one of them was Joschka Fischer, who was the German foreign minister. And he just read the book, and he called me, and he was so complimentary about it, and also had always been somebody very critical of the Nazis. So for coming from him, I was deeply moved that he felt that way. So, you know, one of the things that, as a professor, you also know, writing a review, you got to show that you're smarter than the person who wrote the book. Yes. Yeah.
How, if at all, has the discovery of your Jewish
Yeah. Well, first of all, this has been a part that I have tried to absorb. As I told you, I have a fairly complex religious background. My Catholic phase was all here in Denver. My sister can testify to this, I was kind of a religious fanatic as a child I played priest, which was fairly ambitious. Then I did become an Episcopalian when I got married, and I do go to church. I think somebody asked me the other day whether I'm practicing Jew. I am not. I was raised a Christian. I have the highest respect for Judaism. My grandson is going to be bar mitzvahed in March, so we have a kind of confused combination, but I think it's taught us all an awful lot about tolerance and respect, and so I certainly understand and know the Jewish holidays, and I know the Christian ones, and I am the first Secretary of State that put all Muslim holidays on the U.S. calendar. And we had iftar dinners, and I wrote a book called The Mighty, I call it my God book, The Mighty and the Almighty, which talks about the role of religion in foreign policy. And something that I think a lot of people hadn't considered, especially since we believe in a separation of church and state. But you can't separate people from their faith, and therefore it's important for us to understand what goes on. Yes?
If you had any advice to give Secretary Clinton,
well, first of all, I have to tell you that my youngest granddaughter, when she turned 7 a couple of years ago, said, "So what's the big deal about Grandma Maddie being Secretary of State? Only girls are Secretary of State." which is a little bit different. And before I answer that, I have to tell you about my connection with Secretary Rice. What happened was that my father died in 1977 here in Denver, and by that time he was no longer a displaced person refugee. We actually all got our citizenship down at the courthouse here. And he was a pretty big deal, so there were lots of flowers and tributes and things, and among them was a ceramic pot in the shape of a piano with leaves and things in it. And I said to my mother, "Where did this come from?" And she said, "It's from your father's favorite student, Condoleezza Rice." She had gone to DU, her parents had been associated with it, and she was a music major, hence the piano, and she took an international relations course from my father, and he persuaded her to be an international relations major, and she got her master's at Notre Dame and was back writing her dissertation with my father when he died. So this African-American woman from Alabama, music major, wrote her dissertation on the Czechoslovak military. So in 1987, when I was working for my long string of losing Democratic presidential candidates, I called her up. She was teaching at Stanford, a woman, Soviet expert, and I explained to her that my job for Governor Dukakis was to, by the way, do you all remember Governor Dukakis? And I have to say, I was telling this story at the Kennedy Library, and I'll finish the story in a minute, and all of a sudden the head of the library gets up and says, "Governor Dukakis is in the audience." So he knew that he had lost the Democratic, so I wasn't telling him anything new. But anyway, I just was describing that my job was to get foreign policy experts. So I asked her, and she said, "Madeline, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm a Republican." And I said, "Condi, how could you be? We had the same father." Yeah. So we have a good relationship, and Secretary Clinton and I have a very, very close relationship. I would not have been Secretary of State if it hadn't been for her. And the reason I know that is that President Clinton said so publicly. But I think that she's been a remarkable Secretary of State. And one of the wonderful stories about her, I was in Krakow about 2 years ago. It was the 10th anniversary of something that I started called the Community of Democracies. And she was there in order to honor the concept, and there were representatives of over 100 democracies there. And she gave a good speech on democracy, and then she went off script, and she said, Everybody here knows that I ran against Senator Obama for president, and he beat me fair and square. And then he called me up and said, would I want to be Secretary of State? And she said, I thought about it, and then I decided that it was very important to be a partner and serve my country in that way. And it was the most amazing lesson, I think, to the gathered Democrats there to understand the importance of partnership and alliances and coalitions. So I honor what she has done. I think I would do what she's working like a dog, and she is traveling around a lot. She is, it's described in the papers, her last trip to Africa as kind of a farewell visit, but I'm not sure she sees it that way. I think that she is going to work till the very last minute and do what she can to represent America as best she can, and deal with the Syria issue, try to figure out how to keep solving problems. But I think she's been a terrific Secretary of State, and we talk a lot. So, all the way in the back.
I'm a student at Reed College, and I'm newly studying political science. Do you have any advice for young women?
Yes, it's a growth industry. Let me tell you what I have. I mean, I was one of these people, I think you can tell now by what I've said about my background, we never in my house had anything but foreign policy discussions. Other people might have talked about other things, that's all we did. Wherever I went to school, I started an international relations club and made myself president, and it was kind of the major thing. And I have kidded about this, but I think the reason that President Clinton made me first the UN ambassador to the UN was that when I was a sophomore at Kent, I in fact had won the United Nations contest for the whole Rocky Mountain Empire. And I think it was because I was able to name the 51 countries of the UN in alphabetical order. And then when I went to Wellesley, I majored in political science. I always was very focused on things. And they have now created an institute in my name at Wellesley in terms of creating women for global leadership. And what we are doing is having an interdisciplinary program. So while I love political science and history and even occasionally economics, what I think is really important these days is to study a lot of different kinds of issues. I think it's important to understand science, to realize that global warming has a scientific basis, to study health policy, and to look at religion and anthropology and culture and a variety of other aspects, because countries make decisions a lot on the basis of various other aspects. So I do teach at Georgetown, and what we are advocating to a lot of the School of Foreign Service students is to take a variety of subjects and not just do strictly political science. I hope I haven't screwed up your entire course selection. Yes. Gentleman there.
Yeah.
I did not know about that, and serves him right. I don't understand how anybody can be a member of a neo-Nazi party, and I have to say the following thing. I spent an awful lot of time studying the various revolutions that happened in Central and Eastern Europe. That was my specialty. I studied the role of the media in political change, and I, as chairman, at that stage, vice chairman of the National Democratic Institute, I went around and we did everything we could to try to teach the nuts and bolts of democracy. One of the best parts about no longer being a diplomat is I can actually say everything I think. I am very disappointed in what has happened in Hungary, where Viktor Orban was one of the leaders of what was happening in Hungary, and some of his policies now and his proto-nationalist points of view are not helpful to the people of Hungary or to the evolution of democracy in Hungary or their membership within the European Union. So Yes, sir. Yes.
I wanted to ask you about what your views are with the reset with Russia, failures and successes.
Yeah. Well, I think that our situation with Russia, if I could go back a little bit, is historically and politically very interesting. My book is about World War II, where the Allies flat out defeated Germany on the field of battle. We were two powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, that were enemies for 50 years in a very, very dangerous world with nuclear weapons pointed at each other. And the confrontation ended peacefully. There are those who say that we won the Cold War. The bottom line is I think they lost it because the system didn't work at all. And so we were in office, first President Bush was, and I think they did a terrific job in terms of doing the unification of Germany, which was a very complicated set of issues. And then we came in, and the issue was, how do you devolve the power of your major adversary in a respectful way, having not defeated them on a field of battle? And they were very hard to deal with because just put your, you know, I went over there, I did a lot of surveys there, and the people were mortified. We did focus groups, and they would say, they actually used this, and I don't mean to insult that country, but they said, we're just Bangladesh with missiles. All of a sudden, they were, a country that was not completely developed, and they were embarrassed. They had lost their national identity. And it was very difficult dealing with them in terms of the expansion of NATO and a whole set of issues. And President Putin comes in the first time, and he was very difficult to deal with. There's no question about it. And what he has done now, President Medvedev, I think, had a different approach when the reset actually began. President Putin was selected for any number of reasons, but partially, I think, because he was going to renew Russia's great identity. And so there are a lot of ups and downs in the whole thing. I do think we need to have a functional relationship with Russia, and we will agree on some things and disagree on others, but they are not the foremost power to deal with in this day and age. The foremost power that we have to deal with is China. And I think that is the most important relationship that the United States has in this part of the 21st century. And the Russians, I think, are playing a secondary role, and they are feeling it. And they are playing a very difficult role in Syria. And the question is, why are they doing that? And some of it is just to show that they are still players. But I believe that we have to have a relationship with them. I have to, on a lighter phase, back to the pins. Pins got me into terrible trouble with President Putin. What happened was that we, on the 50th anniversary of NATO, some of you may have seen this picture, but President Clinton and Secretary Cohen and I were on a sofa just sitting there, and somebody went like this, and somebody went like this, and somebody went like this. We looked crazy. So the three monkeys. So I had to go get three monkey pins. So I did. I went and I got the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil monkeys. So then we were going to the summit in Russia in the summer of 2000, and I so disagreed with what President Putin was doing in Chechnya that I wore the monkeys. So we walk in, and he says to President Clinton, so we always watch to see what pins Secretary Albright wears. Why are you wearing those monkeys? So I actually said, because of your Chechnya policy. And he got furious at me. And President Clinton looked at me as if I'd lost my mind and I had just completely screwed up the whole process. So that's when pins got me into trouble. But they got me out of trouble once. And that is that I had actually invented the art of diplomatic kissing. You can't visualize Jim Baker or Henry Kissinger arriving somewhere and having a big embrace. So it's very confusing. The Latin, some kiss on the right cheek and some on the left cheek, and so got bumped noses, and the French kissed twice and the Dutch three times. And then there was Yasser Arafat, just the thought, right? So anyway, so I arrived in South Korea, big embrace. I leave, and all of a sudden I get this phone call from a journalist saying, don't you think that the South Korean foreign minister should be fired for what he said about you? And I said, well, what did he say? He said, well, you know, he said, Secretary Albright and I are about the same age, and I'm this tired old man, and when she comes, she's full of vim and vigor, and when I embrace her, she has very firm breasts. So I said, should be dismissed. What do you have to say to that? And I said, well, I have to have something to put those pins on. Okay, yes.
I was really lucky to spend just a few short days in Rwanda over the summer, and was really struck by the just the beauty and sort of united Rwanda that has come in such recent, you know, a very short time ago that that genocide happened. And I just wondered from your experience, and especially take on media, what can we learn from those Rwanda countries rebuilding, reconstructing, culture building as leadership, and what is good governance there? What can we learn?
Usually the question about Rwanda is not that, but and usually the question is, how did you screw up so badly in Rwanda? It's interesting that you say about the beauty. When I went to Rwanda after the genocide, we flew over from Kigali up to Kyoto. And so beautiful. It was over the land, the gorillas in the mist, and we arrive in this place that's kind of looked more like Switzerland, a lake and a little church, and we got out, and we went to the church, and the church was full of blood, because the church was the killing field. Because what had happened was people ran to the churches in order to get protection, and then they were slaughtered there. And I think that there were so many hard parts to being in Rwanda. I went to a woman's jail. Some of the people in there were nuns. And so many, many contradictions. It was obviously Hutu-Tutsi ethnic cleansing and hideous activity. What is interesting, and I think, again, it makes you realize that not everything is exactly the way it seems. President Kagame has been in many ways a remarkable leader for Rwanda. He had, in fact, been a Tutsi who had come in and put together a force, and then with his government had begun to bring Rwanda back. Rwanda is a very interesting place. Because of the genocide there, many of the men were killed, so there are more women in the government of Rwanda than in many places, and women also play a very large role in the economy. And so it has pulled itself together in many ways in governance with the help of outside and with the desire of the people to run their own lives. The problem, if I may say so now, is President Kagame is accused of being very involved in the situation in Congo. And because the Hutu-Tutsi story had been transferred to the refugee camps in Congo, there is very much of a relationship in terms of those two governments. So I think there are many very good things that are happening in Rwanda under the leadership of President Kagame, but also he deserves some criticism for some of the other issues. But it is important in terms of the nuts and bolts of democracy that I think that they learned there. So, one more question? Yes.
Listening to you is such a gift. And I just feel that I can't understand why the campaign nowadays can't discuss the issues instead of just feeding one another up. And how do you feel?
Well, I agree with you that the campaigns are not very educational at the moment. And I think it's hard to figure out whose fault it really is. I think in many ways, it usually takes me a while to blame the media, but I will do that. I think partially the media is very much into, you know, I find it, I actually watch a lot of TV, but I have problems actually seeing when it says breaking news and flags and the crawl at the bottom and some journalists being hysterical over something that happened without really explaining properly what the issues are. I, for instance, found it very hard to understand what had happened in Egypt, according to the coverage, because they made it sound as if this was some kind of a spectator sport, that it's always dangerous when I use a sports analogy, but the bottom line that it was even a game that didn't have overtime. And so it's a marathon. And I think that we are not properly helped in learning what it is that we have to know. I think that, but we are the people. We should demand that our campaign be more issue related. And I hope that that will happen. I happen to think that one of the big discussions that we need to have is what is the role of government in the 21st century? I happen to believe in government. I think that it is, they actually don't pay taxes in Sudan, and they don't actually have roads in parts of Congo, and some of it has to do with not having functioning governments. And so I think that I would hope that we now will have a discussion that is respectful of us as citizens, but that means that we have to ask the questions. And I think that we do have to take some responsibility in pushing back and thinking that this campaign cannot just be about how much money people have raised. This is not a partisan audience, but I do think that the decision by the Supreme Court on the money was one of the worst decisions that has been taken by the judicial branch, and it has an incredible effect on this campaign. And I think we need to demand that we want to have a discussion because we're smart and we are Americans and we want to know the answers. Thanks for asking that. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.